My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley, and we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter
at Murder and Such.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Family annihilators are not a new phenomenon, but with advances in psychiatry and criminology, we have come to understand them better. With the 24-hour news cycle now in the palm of our hands, these monsters dominate the headlines, despite the fact that familicide is actually quite rare. It's because these crimes are horrific. It's because we have difficulty imagining it happening to someone we know or love, and especially to ourselves. And while experts can point to warning signs or factors, it is always in hindsight. Spree killers or mass murderers are also rare, despite also dominating our media. And it isn't unusual for a spree killer to annihilate his own family before he goes on a rampage. Mark Oren Barton is a family annihilator and a spree killer. He does fit some of the statistical molds we characterize these killers by. But by definition, a spree killer is someone who kills two or more victims in a short time and multiple locations, without a cooling off period. Barton did do this in Atlanta on July 29, 1999, killing 9 people and wounding 13. His total body count would actually be 12 when police found the bodies of his wife and 2 children. What sets Mark Barton apart from these types of killers is that he had killed before, 6 years earlier. That breaks the molds we've come to use for understanding the motivations of a family annihilator or spree killer. Mark Oren Barton, quite simply, may have been a serial killer. Welcome to Episode 61, Family Annihilator and Spree Killer, Mark Barton. Stockbridge, Georgia is part of the Atlanta metropolitan area, meaning it is a suburb of the famous, bustling southern city. It would take a commuter about a half hour to go to work in Atlanta, though with the infamous traffic snarls, I'm sure that commute is closer to an hour these days. The city of Stockbridge is located in the northern part of Henry County, Georgia, which was founded May 15, 1821. The county has an area of approximately 331 square miles located in the Piedmont section of northern Georgia. Henry County lies south of DeKalb, where Atlanta is located. Stockbridge isn't one of the more prevalent suburb cities like Marietta or Alpharetta, which have larger populations. It's a sleepier city, more famous for its small-town hospitality, beautiful parks, and above-average public school system. Today, Stockbridge has around 30,000 residents. In 1999, when today's story takes place, it was much smaller, with under 10,000 residents calling the suburb home. The original Old Stockbridge was a crossroads community when it was settled in 1829, about the time the Concord Methodist Church was organized near the present-day Old Stagecoach Road. There is a bit of controversy about the name Stockbridge, with some insisting the town was named after Levi Stockbridge, a traveling professor who passed through the area multiple times before the post office was built in 1847. But others insist Stockbridge is named for Thomas Stock, who was state surveyor and president of the Georgia State Senate in the 1820s. Either way, the Southern Railroad came in 1881 and was built from Macon to Atlanta, and Stockbridge was swept up in that economic boom. But it remained a small city, retaining its suburban charm into the 20th century. This is where 44-year-old Mark Oren Barton moved with his new younger wife, Leanne, around 1995. 17 years his junior, Leanne Vandiver, began an affair with Mark Barton in 1992. She was a receptionist at the chemical company Lintec International in Douglasville, Georgia, where Mark had recently found work as a salesman. The couple moved to Stockbridge with Mark's 2 young children after the murders of his wife and mother-in-law in 1993. Though officially unsolved, Mark Barton was and is the only suspect in the vicious double murder. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Mark Orrin Barton was born in Clovis Curry, New Mexico on April 2, 1955. He was the only child of Truman and Gladys Barton. Truman Barton was in the United States Air Force and was stationed in Germany when Mark was born. Some sources list Barton as being born in Stockbridge, Georgia, and also Sumter, South Carolina, but this confusion is probably caused by journalistic errors after his death. Probably because the Barton family was restationed in Sumter, South Carolina, where Mark was officially given a Social Security card in November of 1967. Gladys was a housewife and the kinder, gentler parent in the Barton family. It's been reported that Truman was harsh, often cruel, and always decided and delivered the punishment of young Mark. Mark struggled in school in Sumter. He was intelligent, but an introvert. He also stood 6'4" tall and weighed 205 pounds by high school. Despite his physicality, he didn't play sports. He was an academic. But he was a misfit with no friends, much less girlfriends, and he started rebelling against his disciplinarian father with petty crimes. He was caught robbing a drugstore at age 14. Mark excelled in chemistry. He was so good he started making his own psychedelic drugs. He had heard about extracting powder from morning glory seeds and mixing the powder with a chemical solution, and so he tried it, creating a drug similar to LSD. Mark suffered a terrifying overdose of this drug, landing him in the hospital where a psychologist diagnosed him as delusional. Mark said he saw demons coming through the floor and he lost his ability to read. He shaved his head and immersed himself in religious fanaticism, relearning how to read by studying the Bible. In later years, he considered himself a Jehovah's Witness. All of this behavior did little to help with the bullying he faced at school. He had shaved his head and isolated himself even further from his peers. In 1973, Mark graduated from Sumter High School. He attended Clemson University for a semester, but dropped out after having another psychic episode. For the remainder of the school year, Mark received antipsychotic drug therapy. After finishing the drug therapy, Mark enrolled at the University of South Carolina, where he majored in chemistry. While in college, Mark began making and selling methamphetamine. He was also a user and still a petty thief, and so he was arrested again when he was 20 years old when he tried to burglarize a drugstore. He received probation. In 1979, Mark managed to finish college, earning a Bachelor's of Science degree in chemistry from the University of South Carolina. It was while he was attending the University of South Carolina that Mark finally met a young woman who showed him some interest. Deborah Renee Spivey was born on November 29, 1957 in Savannah, Georgia, to parents Bill and Eloise. She had one sibling, a brother named John. Not much else is known about Deborah's early life before her ill-fated marriage to Mark Barton. The two were married in Atlanta, Georgia. Shortly after, Mark got a job in Texarkana, Texas, as a chemist at TLC Manufacturing. Within 5 years, he was a manager with a nice yearly salary. On February 15, 1988, the couple had their first child, a son named Matthew David. Matthew, a Boy Scout, was said to love playing video games. Though the Bartons gave the image of a happy marriage, it was only on the surface. Mark's erratic behavior again was controlling his life. He thought everyone was out to get him and began recording conversations with co-workers. At work, he was also known for his outbursts of temper, often throwing things in the office. He also abused Deborah. He was very controlling, having to know where she was at all times, often accusing her of infidelity. Eventually, TLC Manufacturing had enough of Mark's behavior. He was fired on September 13, 1990. His co-workers noticed he left the building very unhappy. On September 20th, Mark broke into TLC Manufacturing and stole confidential data off of two computers. When he was finished, Mark wiped the hard drives clean. Then he found and stole hard copies of all the data and took it home with him. Mark Barton was the obvious suspect in the burglary. When detectives visited Mark at home, he admitted what he had done. He was arrested and charged with felony burglary. But he was only in jail a few hours before TLC Manufacturing agreed to drop the charges against Mark in exchange for the return of their files. And Mark Barton was required to move out of the state of Texas as part of this deal. So Mark, Deborah, and Matthew relocated to Macon, Georgia. Their second child, a daughter named Michelle Elizabeth, was born there on May 27, 1991. Michelle is often described as a beautiful and sweet little girl. Mark found work at a chemical company called Lintec International in Douglasville, Georgia. Douglasville is a little over 2 hours from Macon, so the family moved again and bought a home in Lithia Springs, about 15 minutes from Douglasville. Not long after starting his new job, Mark began having an affair with a married receptionist named Leanne Lang. They flirted openly at work and were often seen together at after-hours gatherings. Leanne Van Diver was born on February 18, 1972, in Macon-Bibb County, Georgia, to parents Patricia and Joe. She had three siblings and grew up in Lazella, Georgia. She had only been married for about a year before the affair with Mark Barton began. When Mark started seeing Leanne, he bought a new wardrobe and began tanning. Naturally, this made his wife suspicious, though Mark told Deborah she was just being paranoid. Other friends say that Deborah did indeed know of the affair, but chose to ignore it. Whatever Deborah did or didn't know about Leanne, she wasn't aware that Mark took out a $600,000 life insurance policy on her. Deborah kept plodding along in a painful marriage, and in June of 1993, Mark left town with his mistress. They went to meet up with Leanne's friends in North Carolina. While there, Mark told them that he had never loved anyone more than Leanne, and that he would be able to marry her by October. A couple of months later, Leanne left her husband and moved into her own apartment. On Labor Day weekend, just 3 months after his trip to North Carolina, and just 1 month before October, Deborah left for her own small vacation. She and her mother Eloise traveled to the Riverside Campground on Weiss Lake in Alabama to a lakeside trailer where they planned to fish and relax. Deborah had left 5-year-old Matthew and 2-year-old Michelle at home with Mark. Bill Spivey also skipped the trip because he was recovering from a heart attack. The women had planned to be home by Sunday, but by late Sunday evening, others at the campsite became worried when they noticed that the camper and Mrs. Spivey's Thunderbird were still parked in the same spot. Everything was eerily quiet as the other campers decided to check on the women. They walked in on a gruesome crime scene, backed out carefully, and called the police. Both women had been hacked to death with a small axe and were unrecognizable. Eloise had been hit 8 to 10 times, while Deborah's skull was split in half with at least 20 blows to her head and face. There was blood and other body parts splashed all over the walls and curtains of the small trailer. The police immediately found bloody footprints leaving the crime scene and also found that the murderer had vomited in and around the toilet. This indicates the killer probably knew the women. Vomit can sometimes be a good source for DNA, but we don't know that for sure in this case. The crime scene appeared to be a staged burglary. The murderer wanted police to think a burglary had occurred, but police found $600 in cash in Eloise's overturned purse and no signs of forced entry. The police called Bill Spivey and Mark Barton to come to Alabama and noted that Mark did not seem upset at all, and he quickly became extremely uncooperative. A witness at the campground said he had seen a man fitting Mark's description, but a Georgia detective would later reveal that the witness had never seen Mark Barton in a lineup. Investigators seized the floor mats of Mark's Ford Taurus and told him not to clean his car. But it was days later before they tested the rest of the vehicle, and by then, it had been cleaned. But technicians were able to find blood splatters on the steering wheel, console, driver's door, and gear shift. They also found blood in Mark's garage and kitchen wall and sink. Mark said the blood was from when Deborah cut her hand, and he outright refused to undergo a polygraph. Luminol was used to find the blood evidence, but there was not enough blood for DNA testing. Detectives had also found out that Mark had called the company that creates Luminol and would have probably known that while the cops would be able to find traces of blood, there wouldn't be enough for DNA. At one point, Mark even sarcastically said, "If there's a ton of blood in my car, why aren't you arresting me? Why am I not in handcuffs?" Alabama police decided the only way to get a murder conviction was to have Mark confess, but he would not budge. He said he was home with the kids, although he definitely had time to drive to the lake and back. In the end, an investigator insisted that all they had was circumstantial evidence, but no physical evidence to tie him to the murder. Mark had not only cleaned his home and car diligently, but he refused to give a DNA sample that could have been tested against the vomit at the crime scene. I'm not sure why the Alabama police didn't get a warrant for his DNA. Yes, the evidence was circumstantial, but it was overwhelming. Mark was the only suspect, and he had a motive. A mistress, plus a $600,000 life insurance policy on his wife. And as a healthy 38-year-old man, he certainly had the means to brutally murder two unsuspecting women. And he also had opportunity, as there was plenty of time for him to drive from Georgia to Alabama and back in one night. He had no credible alibi other than that he was alone with his two small children. He easily could have murdered his wife and her mother as his children slept. Later, a Georgia detective scoffed and said that if Alabama police had done their jobs, maybe 12 people would be alive today. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Third Love uses data generated by millions of women to design bras with breast size and shape in mind for your perfect fit and the most premium feel. I don't know about you, but I hate the awkward fitting room experiences with bra shopping. With Third Love, you can skip the dreaded shopping trip. You just use Third Love's simple online fit finder, order your bra, and then try it on at home. The fit finder quiz takes about 60 seconds with just a few simple questions. Over 12 million women have taken the quiz to date. And Third Love offers more than 70 sizes, including their signature half-cup sizes. Even better, while other brands base prices on sizing, at Third Love, all bras cost the same, regardless of size. Third Love offers a 100% fit guarantee. Every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. If you don't love it, just return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/southernfried now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/southernfried for 15% off today. Once you're out of your teen years, the last thing you want to do is wear braces. And if you're like me, you've already worn them once and really don't want to do it all over again. But did you know that your teeth move as you get older? If you do want to get them fixed, I'm delighted to tell you about Candid. It's a clear alternative to braces. Candid only uses experienced orthodontists, and they have an orthodontist in your state who can create a treatment plan just for you. They even create a 3D preview of what your final results will look like. Once you've approved your 3D preview, Candid creates custom clear aligners that will be sent directly to your door. That means you don't need to waste time at the orthodontist's office. And Candid costs 65% less than braces. You'll save thousands of dollars and have straighter, brighter teeth in an average of just 6 months. You're one step away from getting straighter, brighter teeth. Learn more at candidco.com/southernfried and use the code southernfried to get $75 off. That's candidco.com/southernfried. Code southernfried for $75 off. In October, the family held a funeral for Deborah and Eloise. It's reported that Mark sat expressionless in the last pew, and as soon as the ceremony ended, he bolted out the door, skipping the burials. Leanne was waiting for him in her Mustang convertible, with the music blaring. He hopped in the car, and they sped away. Leanne moved into the Barton home pretty quickly in October after the funerals and her own divorce was final. Mark was embroiled in a fight with a life insurance company over the policy he had on Deborah because they believe he killed her, despite the failure of Alabama police in arresting him. They wanted the money put into a trust for her children, but Mark refused, and the company eventually settled with him in early 1997. He received $250,000, and the remaining $350,000 was put into a trust for Matthew and Michelle Barton. Less than a year after the murders, Leanne and Mark married on May 26, 1995, and quit their jobs at Lintec. They moved with the children to Morrow, Georgia, where Leanne became the quintessential soccer mom to her new stepchildren. Mark also continued to tussle with Alabama authorities over his first wife's murder. Still adamantly refusing to give a DNA sample or submit to further questioning. Alabama detectives did keep a close eye on him, with one telling CNN that they put psychological pressure on Mark Barton. They knew he did it, and he knew they knew. It was a dangerous game of chess, and the Alabama authorities had no idea just how high Mark Barton's body count would go. Through all of this, Mark's second marriage wasn't faring much better than his first. He and Leanne fought often, with her leaving for a few days, but always returning. Mark was also burning quickly through Deborah's life insurance money with get-rich-quick schemes and day trading. In February of 1994, Michelle, who was almost 3 years old, told a daycare worker that her father had molested her. Mark was ordered to undergo a clinical psychiatric assessment. The test showed he was, quote, certainly capable of homicidal thought and homicidal action. However, given Michelle's age, it was difficult for the state's attorneys to build a solid case around her against Mark or prevent him from keeping custody of his kids. After Mark Barton's spree killings, the Douglas County DA reviewed the 1994 custody hearing records and said, quote, it was disturbing enough to have a trained psychologist and competent prosecutors reporting these things back to us back then. It's absolutely chilling to think about it now. Over the next 4 years, Leanne and Mark's relationship completely crumbled. He was abusive and controlling towards her. Mark also stopped working, and Leanne was supporting him and the two kids. Mark had lost over $100,000 by June of 1997, almost all of it on volatile internet stocks. In 1998, Mark's behavior got even worse. He had run through most of the insurance money. He also killed the family cat, but then took his children out to search for this missing cat. In February of 1998, Mark began working for Alltech Investment Group. Mark started with a self-funded $50,000 trading account. By March, Mark had drained the account and owed Alltech over $11,000. Because his account was negative, he was forced to stop trading. In April, he came back to Alltech and told them he invented a new soap and made a lot of money. And he did repay his debts and resupplied his $50,000 trading account. But by May, Mark was back to where he was before. This time he owed the company $30,000. Mark told his boss, Brent Doonan, that he would go back to making soap and he would be back soon with the $30,000 he owed them. Brent and Mark did remain in contact. In October of 1998, Leanne finally left Mark. According to Leanne's sister Dana, Leanne left because she was tired of supporting Mark while he wasn't working. However, there had been marital problems since the beginning. But Leanne Barton now missed her stepchildren. She had raised them as her own for 5 years, and so she let Mark and the kids move into her Stockbridge apartment in late June or early July of 1999. Mark got a new job trading stocks at Momentum Securities on June 9th. He soon owed Momentum Securities money as well, except this time it was much more than what he owed Alltech. By June 26th, Mark owed Momentum Securities $187,000. The walls were closing in on him. On Tuesday, July 27th, 1999, Mark bludgeoned Leanne Barton to death with a hammer as she was sleeping. He hid her body in a closet behind boxes and clothes. The next day, he stayed home with his children, 11-year-old Matthew and 8-year-old Michelle. Mark also bludgeoned his children with a hammer and then put them face down in the bathtub to make sure they were dead before drying them off, redressing them, and tucking them into their beds. Matthew was found with his favorite video game next to him, and Michelle was found with her teddy bear. Then on Thursday morning, July 29th, Mark went to his attorney's office and made some changes to his will. He then headed to Momentum Securities in the Buckhead area of Atlanta's financial district at around 2:20 p.m. After chatting nonchalantly with his ex-coworkers for a few minutes, Mark learned that the day had been bad for stock trading. Mark then said, quote, "It's a bad trading day, and it's about to get worse." And then he pulled out a .45 caliber Colt and a 9mm Glock and opened fire. First, he killed 38-year-old Kevin Dial with two shots, one in the back and the other in the heart. After killing Kevin, Mark walked down the rows of workstations. 30-year-old Scott Webb was the second to be shot. The bullet entered one of his lungs. Andrew Zapperzala and James Jordan were shot at next. Andrew was not hit, but James suffered two non-fatal wounds, one in the side and the other in the arm. Next, Brad Schomel was shot twice, once in the back and once in the shoulder. 58-year-old Edward Quinn was fatally shot in the neck. And then Mark headed towards the receptionist, Marcy Brooking, and shot her point blank, but she miraculously survived. Next, Mark fatally shot 42-year-old Russell Brown three times. Employees were hiding under desks as Mark Barton continued to stalk around the building, shooting both guns. Mark went up to Scott Webb and shot him again. He also shot Brad Schomel a third time. By the time Mark left the Momentum Securities building, he had killed four people: Edward Quinn, Kevin Dial, Russell Brown, and Scott Webb. The first call to 911 was at 2:56 p.m. Mark then walked across the street to the Alltech Investment Group building. As he walked into the building at 3 o'clock p.m., Mark said, "I hope I'm not upsetting your trading day." His previous manager, Brent Doonan, thought Mark was coming in to repay the money as he had promised. Mark asked Brent if the two of them could talk. Brent said yes, but he needed a minute. While waiting for Brent, Mark ran into another office, that of manager Scott Manspeaker and his assistant Kathy Van Camp. The three were chatting when Scott noticed that Mark had red splatters on his arms, hands, and shirt. As the three of them walked back to the main office, Mark closed the blinds. He then left the office and headed back to the conference room where Brent was. He opened the door and said, "Brent, come here quick. Really, you're going to love this." Brent followed Mark into the main office. Once in the office, Mark closed the door and told Brent, Scott, and Kathy, quote, "Today is going to be visual." Then he lifted up his shirt and took out the two guns he had in his waistband. He immediately shot Brent twice and then shot at both Scott and Kathy. Scott was hit in the arm and gut, while Kathy was shot in her face. Mark then left the main office and headed out into the open trading floor and began shooting. 45-year-old Jamshid Havash was shot in the back by Mark's 9mm, dying where he fell. Yusuf Liberson was shot in the head, and Fred Herter was shot in the back, but both survived. Dean Delawalla, 52, tried to make it to an exit, but Mark shot him in the back before he could make it. He was shot again as he fell to the floor. 48-year-old Alan Tenenbaum was shot in the upper back, torso, and right shoulder. Joseph Desert, 60, was shot twice by the .45 caliber, once in the shoulder and once in the chest. All of the men died almost instantly. Meredith Forrester was shot in the lower back, but survived. As they were seeking shelter, Charles Williams, Harry Higginbotham, Sang Yoon, and Meredith Winnett were all shot. Charles suffered a chest wound, Harry a head wound, Sang a head wound, and Meredith a back wound, and yet somehow they all survived. Meanwhile, Brent Doonan was attempting to escape from the conference room. When he came out, he spotted Mark Barton still shooting. Although he was badly wounded, Brent was able to tackle Mark as he aimed to shoot another employee. After the tackle, Mark got up quickly. Brent took off running as Mark shot off two rounds at him. The first bullet hit Brent's left arm and the second hit Brent's left shoulder blade. But Brent spotted an exit and headed down the hallway. He found the elevator and pressed the down button. As he waited for the elevator, he saw Mark Burton appear at the other end of the hallway. Brent was able to close the elevator doors just as Mark pointed the gun and fired off a round. Brent also miraculously survived and lived to write a book about the massacre. As police responded to the 911 calls from the Momentum Securities building, an employee inside the Altec building called 911. The operator misunderstood the caller and believed the address she had just received was the same one as the Momentum Securities building. She told the caller police were already there. Because police did not respond to the Altec office, Mark Burton was able to leave the building, get into his minivan, and leave undetected. Five people were killed in the Altec office that afternoon. Alan Tenenbaum, Dean Delawalla, Joseph Desert, Jamshid Havash, and Vadawat Moral Dahara, who was not an Altec employee, but had been in the building taking a computer course. After Mark left, Brent stumbled into another office in the same building. The employees of that department called 911. At the same time, a motorcycle officer heard gunshots coming from the Altec office building. The officer went inside and found the crime scene. He called for backup, but the operator said he was at the wrong building. It took 30 minutes before a commanding officer figured out that there were crime scenes at two different areas. An Altec employee thought to go through the HR records and found Mark Burton's file and handed it over to police. Police called in SWAT and searched nearby buildings. They set up roadblocks and searched all cars. They had three helicopters searching for Mark Burton and his minivan. But they had bad information. Mark's minivan was green and they had been told it was white. And authorities had no idea where he was headed. For hours, officers with shotguns searched the parking decks at Piedmont Center and several office buildings. Employees remained locked in their offices for their safety. Police dogs sniffed the bushes, and FBI agents dressed for war searched the area along Piedmont Road. 4 hours passed before authorities heard from someone who had seen Mark Burton. Security officers at the Town Center Mall in Kennesaw, about 20 miles from Buckhead, saw Mark's unoccupied van in the mall lot around 7:40 p.m. At about the same time, a woman who had been shopping at Rich's approached her parked car. Mark walked towards her and said, "Don't scream or I'll shoot you." And then she backed away and he said, "Don't run or I'll shoot you." But she ran. And thankfully, this time, Mark Burton did not shoot. After he left the mall parking lot, police caught sight of Mark driving. They began following him and saw Mark enter an Ackworth BP gas station parking lot. As he circled the station, police cruisers blocked both entrances to the station. When Mark pulled around, he saw the Ackworth police. As the police surrounded the vehicle, they ordered him to throw his gun out of the window, exit the van, and lie face down on the ground. But Mark Burton had no intention of being taken alive. He pointed the .45 at his left temple and the 9mm to his right. Only one of the guns fired. But it was enough. Mark Burton, family annihilator, and spree killer, was finally dead. In the van, police found four handguns, 200 rounds of ammunition, and a large amount of cash. The on-scene sergeant called for an ambulance and then headed to Barton's apartment. When police arrived at the apartment, they found a typed letter in the living room that read, "To whom it may concern, Leanne is in the master bedroom closet under a blanket. I killed her on Tuesday night. I killed Matthew and Michelle Wednesday night. There may be similarities between these deaths and the death of my first wife, Deborah Spivey. However, I did not kill her and her mother. There is no reason for me to lie now." It just seemed like a quiet way to kill and a relatively painless way to die. There was little pain. All of them were dead in less than 5 minutes. I hit them with a hammer. I'm so sorry. I wish I didn't. Words cannot tell the agony. Why did I? I have been dying since October. To wake up at night so afraid, so terrified that I couldn't be that afraid while awake. It has taken its toll. I have come to hate this life and this system of things. I have come to have no hope. I killed the children to exchange them for 5 minutes of pain for a lifetime of pain. I forced myself to do it to keep them from suffering so much later. No mother, no father, no relatives. The fears of the father are transferred to the son. It was from my father to me and from me to my son. He already had it. And now to be left alone, I had to take him with me. I killed Leanne because she was one of the main reasons for my demise. I really wished I hadn't killed her now. She really couldn't help it, and I loved her so much anyway. I know that Jehovah will take care of all of them in the next life. I am sure the details don't matter. There is no excuse, no good reason. I am sure no one will understand. If they could, I wouldn't want them to. I just write these things to say why. Please know that I love Leanne, Matthew, and Michelle with all my heart. If Jehovah's willing, I would like to see them all again in the resurrection to have a second chance. And then Mark's last words were chilling. He wrote, I don't plan to live very much longer, just long enough to kill as many of the people that greedily sought my destruction. You should kill me if you can. Signed, Mark O. Barton. On Matthew's body, police found a handwritten note that read, I give you my son, my buddy, my life. Please take care of him. On Michelle's body, police found a handwritten note that read, I give you my daughter, my sweetheart, my life. Please take care of her. Finally, police found a handwritten note on Leanne's body that read, I give you my wife, Leanne Barton, my honey, my precious love. Please take care of her. I will love her forever. Leanne's funeral was held on August 1, 1999. She was buried in the Old Valley Grove Primitive Baptist Church Cemetery in Irwin County, Georgia. Matthew and Michelle's funerals were held on August 2nd. They were buried at Sunrise Memorial Gardens in Lithia Springs. I would also like to give you short biographies of all of Mark's victims. Keep in mind that day traders were not always full-time employees at the companies Mark targeted. For some, it was part-time work. For others, it was a hobby. One poor woman was just in the building taking a computer class. Alan Tenenbaum was a father of three who worked at his family-owned grocery. He was the president of his synagogue, and he loved to golf and jog. Dean Delawalla was a devoted father of two. He came to America from Pakistan in 1973. In Pakistan, he had been a lawyer and a banker. Kevin Dial was the son of Pittsburgh Steelers and Dallas Cowboys wide receiver Buddy Dial. He was described as a happy, very bright, and wonderful man. He was a graduate of the University of Texas, and he was known for his sense of humor. Edward Quinn was a father of three who had recently retired from UPS. He loved working on his lawn, fly fishing, and golf. He was a devoted family man who had become a grandfather for the first time just 3 weeks prior to his death. Vaidwa Miral Dehara was a mother of two. She was a, quote, very sweet-spirited person who was dedicated to her family. She was a native of Trinidad and Tobago and the wife of a pediatrician. Scott Webb liked to bike and jog. He was described as popular and athletic. He graduated with a degree in biology from Loyola University. He was very close to his father, and he was a gifted tennis player. Joseph Desert was an avid golfer. He attended a prayer breakfast every Friday morning. He was known for running in races. He had many friends and was known to say positive and encouraging things to everyone he encountered. Russell Brown was, quote, so kind he couldn't bear to kill a bug. He was great at math, track, and swimming. He was a CPA and had left law school with one semester left to take care of his brother and father who were dying of cancer. He had a beloved cat named Sweetie McMack. Jamshid Havash was a leader in his community and a sports fan. He had a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and two graduate degrees from Georgia Tech. He was a father of one. As for Mark Barton's surviving victims, many sued Alltech and Momentum for not looking into Mark Barton's background when he was hired. But all of the cases were dismissed. Brent Doonan moved home to Wichita, Kansas in 2001. He published a book called Murder at the Office and is working in his family's trucking business. He's married with a son. Scott Manspeaker also moved back to Wichita, Kansas. Nell Jones stayed in Atlanta. She went back to real estate law and was semi-retired in 2009. Kathy Van Camp was blinded by the shot to her face. As of 2009, she had gone through 15 surgeries to repair her face. She eventually moved to Hawaii with her husband. Sadly, she said the last thing she ever saw was Mark Barton's face. Meredith Forrester's chance of survival was 1 in 1,000. After going through 115 pints of blood, Meredith survived 2 emergency surgeries. She is missing a disc in her lower back. She has scoliosis in her upper back, nerve damage in her right leg, and extensive scar tissue throughout her abdomen. She was wheelchair-bound for a while, but is miraculously walking again. According to the Taipei Times, Fred Herder committed suicide in December 2001. He had lost $400,000 in 3 years through day trading, but we cannot discount the trauma he survived and had to live with after Mark Barton's massacre at Altec. I consider him to be the 10th victim of the killing spree that fateful July day. As I said in the opening, it's possible and fair to call Mark Barton a serial killer, because even within academic literature, there is debate on how to distinguish a spree killer from a mass murderer or a serial killer. Was there a cooling-off period? Were the murders done in commission of other crimes? Were the murders for revenge or for attention? Were the victims random or targeted? Adding to the confusion is the fact that the terms are not used consistently by law enforcement, academics, or the media. Spree killers don't resume their normal lives between murders. And yet we know that Mark Barton did. He attempted to live a new life and put 6 years between his murders. His rampage at Momentum Securities and Altec fall within the spree killer definition. But he also murdered his entire family, including his first wife and mother-in-law, putting him squarely in the family annihilator category. And he killed for money. It was not for the thrill of killing, as his vomit at the first crime scene illustrated. And from his letters for the police in Stockbridge, he did seem to feel guilty about killing his children and second wife, though this guilt did not stop him. He planned the murders carefully. I do find it odd that even in his suicide note, he still denied the murders of his first wife and mother-in-law. Why would he lie then? Maybe Alabama did get it right. And maybe Mark Barton just would not give Alabama the satisfaction of a confession for those murders. I'm not sure that Mark Barton can be put into any one classification. But considering that he checks boxes in just about every category, maybe he can simply be called a serial killer. But does it really matter? He killed 15 people. Mass murderer. Serial killer. Spree killer. Family annihilator. These are all labels for the same thing. A monster. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Haley Gray for her diligent research on this intricate and brutal case. Don't forget, I'm doing a live show with Alicia and Stacy from the podcast Trashy Divorces called The Scattered, Covered, and Smothered Tour. It's Southern Fried Trashy Divorces, and we are so excited. It will be in Atlanta on Sunday, August 25th at Vankman's, and the doors open at 5 p.m. I've got a link to buy tickets in the show notes. There will be a Southern-inspired menu for the evening, different types of seating for different tiers, and a meet and greet for VIP guests that you can also add on to any other ticket. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Sometimes private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.